Welcome to the Jordan Family Podcast, where we talk all things Jordan, past, present, and future. So sit back, turn your volume up, and get ready to join us on the Jordan Family Podcast. This podcast will begin in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hey, we're back with episode 4. We took a little bit of hiatus on our recording because of springtime and everybody's mowing yards, so pretty weather. We've had a lot of stuff to do. And so how you been doing lately, Keith?
Doing pretty decent. Yourself?
Not too bad. So just enjoying the weather we've been having and trying to get all my winter stuff that I wanted to get done this spring. So keep me busy. And I know you've been mowing a lot too, I hear.
Yeah, been keeping busy.
Well, we'll get started with this podcast, and I think when we left off, the big move from Shadle Farm was coming up on the hill, and they made their way up on the hill, and we had a few stories about that. We'll try to tell a little bit more about life out on the hill, so we'll see if we can do a very good job on this. We got some new information, right, I think, to share with everybody, so...
That's always good and usually entertaining, some of the stories.
Yeah, at least to us, and that's what most important is us. So. No, I'm just teasing. This is for everybody. So, but anyway, we'll go ahead and start before we get too carried away with our small talk here. Okay, the firstborn Jordan out on the hill, do you know who it was, Keith? He goes by the name of Uncle.
Oh, that narrows it down. Would it be Uncle Jim?
Uncle Jim, yep. And we always called him Big Jim. That's what we all called him. So he was born a few years after the move out on the hill. I believe it was October 20th of 1937. Shortly after all those boys in the row, finally another daughter made it into this world. Can you guess who that might have been? This one might be pretty close and dear to you.
Mama.
Your mom, yes. Aunt Jewel. She was in December of 1939. And then the last Jordan girl born, which was my mom, Phyllis, came along in October of 1941. And Mom Phyllis was born on Grandma Carrie's birthday. And I know that was always special to Mom and Grandma, which it would be for any parent, I think, to have a kid born on your birthday.
Right.
And Keith, that year of 1941 had some happenings after my mom was born. Do you know what those was?
Yes, Danny. December 7th, 1941, FDR described it as a day that would live in infamy, the attack on Pearl Harbor. The USS Arizona was one of the first ships that was taken down, and one of the first ships that was torpedoed was the USS West Virginia. I don't think a lot of people really realize that or pay much attention to that, because it's always, you know, not the very first one, but one of the first ones taken down due to torpedoes was the USS West Virginia.
Yeah, there was a boy from Point Pleasant on that USS West Virginia that actually worked at the plant. And Uncle Wilbur told me this story before. I'll have to get his name. It just came to me when he was talking. But he went down with the ship and jumped off and kind of got to safety. And he hid out for a long time. Well, the military thought he was dead, had done notified his family back home that he was killed in the West Virginia explosion.
Right.
And they had his funeral and everything here as a memorial for him. And then, like, I forget how much longer later, he showed up back to the barracks and checked in. So I'm sure that was a shock. Shock to his parents, but of a relief too.
Right.
I'll get his name in the future. At the end of this episode, I'll get a hold of Willie and find out his name and tell that. But it was a pretty good story.
I'll have to look that up and see if I can find like any newspaper articles or anything.
If you do, we'll feature that on here sometime. I know he wasn't family, but still it was somebody our family worked with, so I thought it was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to the price of goods and stuff during that time period, maybe during the...
Well, I mean, when the Pearl Harbor attack happened, there was, 2,403 Americans that were killed right then, and I think there was like another 1,178 that was wounded. So there was quite a bit happening as far as that, and that drawing us into the war. And of course, there's some historians that go into the line of thinking that some of our government knew that the attack was imminent and kind of just let it happen because they wanted an excuse to get into the war because the public at that point was against it, and they were wanting us to just stay out of it. And they knew that if that happened, then public demand would change and they would be wanting it.
Yeah, especially with the economic times of coming, what now, the Great Depression years, and kind of led into that. I'm a conspiratist, so I can see that happen.
Right. As far as the price of certain things, like milk was 27 cents for a half a gallon, eggs was 40 cents a dozen, coffee was 24 cents a pound, sugar was 6 cents a pound, butter 41 cents a pound, steak was 39 cents a pound, bacon 34 cents a pound, cars, $925 for a brand new car. Gasoline, 19 cents a gallon. Postage stamp was 3 cents. The stock market, by the way, was 111.
Wow.
And the house cost $6,900 for a house, and that was $32 a month. And I think the average wage was around $2,000, $2,100, something on that line.
Gotcha. Is that your dogs barking by chance?
It is.
What's their names? We have to introduce your dogs. They're wanting in the podcast. So.
hold on just a second, because I want to see if I can calm them down.
Hey, Keith, you want to tell us the name of your dogs?
Well, we have Elizabeth. We have Chester, and the loud one that everybody can hear is Lyra, and she's technically Peyton's dog.
So blame it on Peyton, then.
Mm-hmm.
But so coming out of the start of this World War II is what led Pearl Harbor, like I said, got us into World War II. And during World War II, Grandpa went to work at the Marietta manufacturing plant, making ships. And I am pretty fond of that place, and I think you are too, Keith. My grandpa Bonecutter also worked there, starting around the same time as the war broke out, and retired there years later as a machinist. Also, both of our dads worked there as well, later on in their life, or later on. And I believe Harold moved back from Columbus area to go to work there, also as a machinist, and did till it shut down. And my dad Danny got his Boilermaker's card from there and moved on to work in some construction jobs. So it's kind of neat that, it is on my part that both of my grandparents kind of worked there at the same time. And I knew they knew each other too, so I always thought that was kind of neat. And then our dads worked there later on at the same plant. And I think they contributed a lot to the war effort back in...
Oh, yeah, they big time did. Got a fair amount of information on the Marietta plant if you want to hear
We'll definitely hear it, because I heard Grandpa had to also walk a ways to get to work on these jobs as well. He would catch a ride after walking a couple miles with a guy who lived on Crab Creek. And also during this time, he went to work at the new, now the world-famous TNT plant. And this, I'm going to have Donald tell us a little bit about that. And when we come back, after Donald talks, I'll have you give a little information about the places that they was working at.
Okay.
It was during the war when they was building them ships up there.
Okay.
And he worked up there as a fitter.
Okay.
And then he worked at the TNT, too.
I did not know that.
Yeah, he worked at the TNT plant. I mean, up there where in the TNT area where they made that explosives and stuff.
All during World War II, then?
Yeah.
Did he walk it, or did he get a ride? Or a
ride, I think.
Okay.
And when he worked up the Marietta plant, now do you think people didn't walk? He worked up there at the Marietta plant, I think. And you remember old Stevens living across from Dad?
Mm-hmm.
All right, he rode up there with him. He would walk out there on the hill, work nights up in Marietta. And he'd walk down there to old Stevens and ride to town with him.
Wow.
And Og would let him out when they come home. And he'd walk all the way back
out there. Instead of driving him out, throwing him back out there, he made him walk.
He'd no more than get out there, so he'd have to go again.
Well, it'd be miles to getting out there, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Okay, Keith, do you know much about the Marietta plant or the TNT area?
Okay, let's start with the Marietta plant. A lot of people don't know that it originally started in, like, 1852... as the W.F. Robertson and Sons. And they basically had it until there was a fire in the 1870s, and they moved it to Marietta, Ohio. And then 1892, they sold the company, and it was the name became the Marietta Manufacturing Company. Then in 1913, there was a catastrophic flood that happened, and it had hit Point Pleasant also, but Point Pleasant set out trying to find new businesses because they had been hit hard by the flood as well, and because it was elevated a little more than what Marietta was, and the confluence of the Kanawha and the Ohio Rivers, they decided to move it to Point Pleasant, and they opened it up in 1915 in Point Pleasant and began making steam engines for the government during World War I. But they did not get into full-fledged ship production until 1918. And that led to huge growth for the company during the 1920s. Now, during World War II, the company started building mine planters for the U.S. Navy and tugboats for the Army. And they, in 1944, they were given an E award for exceptional service during wartime production. And they would go on to provide, like, all kinds of watercraft for the U.S. military, such as landing crafts, patrol boats, survey ships. And there's an economic decline during the 60s, and Marietta ceased operations in 1970, and the facility was bought by Amherst Industries and became active again under the name of Point Pleasant Marine Company. The new companies, you know, they offered repair services and building vessels there as well, and it shut its doors for good in 1984.
Huh, pretty interesting. I didn't know that company went that far back.
Yeah, I didn't actually realize it either.
Yeah. The TNT area is,
yes, sir,
we're all pretty familiar with it around here, but those listening that's not, I know it's got why it became world famous in the late 60s, but back when Grandpa was working there, what was being built and the first things they did, do you have any information on that one?
Well, it was called the TNT area because during World War II, that region, that area, was more than 8,000 acres, and it was devoted to ammunition manufacturing. And it employed quite a few people at its peak. For safety reasons, the explosives were stored in bunkers, which we always called them the igloos. And those were strategically scattered across the 8,000 acres and disguised as a thick layer of earth. After the war, it kind of became abandoned and became part of the wildlife management area. And it was discovered that in the 1980s that the land was severely contaminated by explosive byproducts. And it was added to the federal list of hazardous waste sites. And, well, today it's mostly used for hunting and fishing areas.
And the occasional Mothman site. You can't forget the Mothman when you mention TNT.
No, when I was looking this up, I don't remember this, but of course I have some issues with my brain and don't always remember things like I should, but when I came across this thing saying that in May of 2010, that one of the igloos exploded.
I think it did.
20,000 pounds of unstable materials, and it just suddenly exploded.
Yeah, I believe it did.
I don't remember that.
I can remember it happening, but I don't know the whole details of it. But I knew it opened up a pretty big hole in the ground, I believe. But it's always TNT, like I said, we always, where the fairgrounds is now, I think, is where the plant kind of was situated and how big it really was. We just don't, in our mind, we just can't picture how big it was. But where I've hunted up there a few times, you know, I've been walking around and stumble up on like a railroad track out in the middle of the woods that, or some kind of little building foundation and that had been part of the old plant. And I remember the old Buller house there behind the fairgrounds that stood there for years, too, till they finally tore it down.
Now, I've never hunted there. I've fished there before, but I've never hunted. I went driving around, you know, just being goofy a time or two. But my favorite memory involving anything TNT was when I was working on my bachelor's degree. I had a night class in Point Pleasant, and I had worked. I went in to work like at 6 in the morning, and it was, by this time, it was 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night, and I hadn't really stopped all day, and I was just tired. So as soon as I got out of class, I headed home, and I was going down Route 2, and I was cranking pretty close to 100 miles per hour. And got there to where the RNL is now, and all of a sudden I saw all these police lights. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I am in big trouble. And I was like, well, there's nothing I can do other than say I'm sorry, tired. And so I started slowing down. And it wasn't just one or two police cars, it was like 4, 5, 6. And they all just kept busting past me. And I'm thinking, I'm going 100 miles an hour. And they just ignored me, essentially. And I'm thinking, what's going on? What happened? And, well, when I got home and watched the 11 o'clock news, they had found a body up there at TNT in a pond, and they were busting up there to get to that.
Yeah, I hate to hear that, but it saved you a big ticket and probably a trip to jail, didn't it?
Definitely a big ticket.
Yeah. Oh wow. Yeah, I bet your heart sunk on that one.
That was you know, probably reckless driving and you know, whatever else.
Yeah. So. But anyway, we'll get back to our story now and the past here. No, that's funny. I'm sure everybody get a kick out of that. We also want to make mention of our uncle and the firstborn son of Grandma and Grandpa, Uncle Harry. He was actually in the service during World War II. He got in more towards the end of the war and during the occupation stage and afterwards. And Uncle Willie has kind of told us about where he was stationed at, I believe, when he was ever. So I'll let Uncle Willie tell us about that.
So Harry was World War II. Mm-hmm. Who'd you say he, where was he at? Where was Harry?
Germany or Europe. I don't know where. But
what was he guarded? Who did he guard?
Prisoners there at Nuremberg when they had been Nuremberg trials for okay. war criminals.
Yeah, war crimes, yeah.
The war crimes, yeah.
So he was there.
Mm-hmm. And then, so he had after war ended, he had a year's occupation over there.
Oh, okay.
What they called occupation.
Yeah. So he got the good end of the deal on that one.
Keith, do you have any information on what the Nuremberg trials or where he was stationed over there?
Yeah, Nuremberg is one of the bigger places in Germany. And it was like a strong, had a strong presence of Nazis. I mean, they would hold huge rallies during Hitler's time. They would hold huge rallies there frequently. And between 45 and 46, German officials involved in war crimes and crimes against humanity were brought before an international tribunal there. Nuremberg was chosen as the site because of it being so important to the Nazis. And they had a palace of justice, and it was undamaged by the war, and it was spacious, and they thought, well, that's an excellent place to have court, you know, for the trials. So they were held there, and many prominent German Nazi politicians and military leaders went to trial there and executed there as well.
So Harry was probably there guarding the city to make sure that the German army didn't come back, or somebody, probably uprisings, I suppose.
Right, because, as an invading presence, there was probably groups of people that would get together and come up with the idea of maybe trying to take some shots or, try to cause a little bit of an uprising. So, yeah.
Yeah, so he probably seen a lot of interesting stuff and wasn't in hand-to-hand combat a lot, thank goodness. So he probably was thankful he got in towards the end of it, I suppose. But he was there making United States history, so that's kind of interesting to me.
Right. Yeah, it was key to Hitler's rise to power because, like I said, they had a lot of rallies. And when Hitler was growing in power was when they were doing this. And so, it was definitely a thing with it being an extreme importance to the Nazi people. And that's, again, why they held the trials there.
What better way to fix a problem than send the Jordan?
Right on.
So, okay, well, like I said, a little bit about Uncle Harry and World War II. And I'm sure, like I said, it affected a lot of people back home here. And Grandma and Grandpa having a kid, and that was their first kid over there. I'm sure they struggled with that a lot and worried deeply about him. Okay, we'll continue our stories here a little bit. I got one about Uncle Dom was telling me about. And it was about this car that he used to ride in. It was a 34 Pontiac. That was owned by Grandpa John when he was living there around Horseshoe Bend. So Don's going to tell us about it and a little story about potatoes that Donald remembered.
Sounds good.
In there at Horseshoe Bend, at the right Horseshoe there. Bend. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I picked up potatoes in behind there.
Oh, did you?
I was just a little boy and mosquitoes about eat me. I had just shorts on.
Oh, my gosh.
And then he more they bragged, the better I'd work.
Fell right for it.
I wasn't very big. And then Dad got the car out of the garage at Pontiac. And we drove it home. about your life, didn't he?
Yeah. What kind of car did John have?
He had I think it was a 34 Pontiac convertible with the rumble seat in it. And it was a pretty little thing, I'll tell you that.
That's a pretty good story about the old 34 Pontiac, which I would love to have that now to ride around in myself. And also, Don had this funny pig story with him, Grandma and Grandpa, and Uncle Jim's actually involved in this one, too. So we'll let Don go ahead and tell us the pig story riding in the car.
We went up to Lanier's, me and Dad, Mom, and Jimmy. We went up to the up there and bought two pigs for butcher at winter. And they put them in coffee sacks and cut a hole in it for their nose to stick up. Put them back in the floor of that rumble seat. Well, me and Jimmy's riding back there, and I was afraid of them. I got up on the back of the seat where you raise the lid up, and I was sitting up on that lid with my feet in the seat where they couldn't get me. And Dad had pulled her over, and he just come a one from giving me a good thrashing. Made me get down in there and sit. I told him I was afraid of them pigs. They was in sacks.
Oh, see.
Closer now to the mid-40s, Uncle Larry, but we know him as our Uncle Buck, was born November of 1943. And the last, but not least, the baby of the family arrived. Uncle Wilbur, or Willie, as I called him, was born July 25th, 1945. And Uncle Willie might have been born just a tad earlier than he was supposed to be. So here's a story of the day that Uncle Willie was born.
Black age. She'd seen a snake before that. She thought the snake, that it was a snake he threw on her.
Oh, God.
Threw right into labor.
Right. How early was he?
2 months, I believe.
Yeah.
And he weighed 315 or something like that.
Oh, wow, that's little.
Oh, he was, though. They carried him on a pillow.
Wow.
Daddy hollered, "Johnny, don't you do what I think you're going to do," but it was too late.
Yeah.
Well, the legend of Uncle Willie started with the legend of Uncle Johnny and his fake snake. This story is funny looking back now, and also a testament to Uncle Johnny's orneriness, but also to the care Grandma and Grandpa had to have given Uncle Willie for him to survive being born that early back then.
Yeah, Mom said she thought he was around 3 pounds, 15 ounces. And, you know, from my time when I worked at Children's Services, I would see there would be babies born to, like, parents that were on various drugs or whatever, and they'd be under 4 pounds, and they'd be in incubators and all this modern equipment, you know, and they would still be touch and go at times. So, you know, to have way back then a kid that was born that early and only weighing less than 4 pounds would, without any of the modern medicines or any of the equipment to keep them, you know, surviving, is pretty amazing, really.
Oh, definitely. He definitely spent some time in the NICU unit and the ICU for months,
right,
probably at that age,
exactly.
This day and age. So I think it's pretty much a testament on how they took care of him, and probably a lot of prayers involved in that one, too, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the end of this episode. We will continue on from this point for our next. I'm Danny Bonecutter, along with my co-host Keith Durst. We want to thank you for listening to the Jordan Family Podcast.